This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Gone are the days of graduating from college, paying your dues with a few entry-level positions, and landing a 30-year career with a big corporation, complete with retirement benefits. There's no such thing as job security. Whole industries are disappearing, just as new ones, some that couldn't have been imagined a short time ago, are emerging. Meanwhile, thanks to technology, workers are under constant pressure to be available at all times. My guest reports that about 40% of us will be self-employed on some level by the end of this decade, and believes that amassing a range of skill sets and professional networks is a requirement to prosper in the 21st century. Today, we talk with Ann Kramer. She's the author of It's Always Personal and Going Gray. She's worked as a columnist for Fast Company and Martha Stewart Living. Her work has appeared in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, as well as other publications. She currently blogs for Harvard Business Review and Next Avenue. Kramer was executive vice president and worldwide creative director of Nickelodeon. Her latest book is Risk Reward: Why Intelligent Leaps and Daring Choices Are the Best Career Moves You Can Make. Ann Kramer also happens to be married to Kurt Anderson, who's a novelist and host of the public radio program Studio 360. She joins us today by phone from New York. Ann Kramer, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
You say we need to learn how to embrace risk in our working lives, and that not taking risks is the riskiest career move of all. Can you explain what you mean?
Yes, I think back in the 20th century, you know, as you alluded to in your introduction, there was the expectation that you would join a firm, a company, and sort of start at the ground level and rise vertically up through the ranks until you reached some kind of management level and kind of cruise along in that position until retirement and retire with a very attractive pension. I believe that a couple of things conspired. First, starting in the late 80s, when shareholder value became the kind of holy grail of corporations, and they began to kind of focus on the quarterly short term rather than a kind of long-term investment strategy, employees began to be viewed as kind of expensive items on the P&L, and they began to force workers to be contract employees, to sort of cut their benefits. And it began the kind of schism that I think happens today, where companies lost faith and appreciation of the value of employees. Compound that with the Great Recession, when, you know, companies were going out of business right and left, and we've reached this place where we are in our society today, where I don't think there's anybody who actually feels 100% secure in their working lives. You know, even professors who are tenured at universities, I believe, are now feeling that that is being threatened on some level. And government employees are nervous in terms of their ability to stay in their jobs. So there really is nowhere in society where you can kind of look and say, well, I can kind of go there and continue to prosper for the rest of my life. Even if you're in medicine, for instance, you have to sort of keep changing and doing things constantly to stay adept and abreast of what's going on. So rather than just cruise along and assume that everything is going to be okay, what I advocate in the book and what I found through my research is that if you kind of develop a risk practice, if you take daily risks large and small in different ways, you develop your resiliency muscles, you develop your capacity to sort of think about new opportunities on the horizon, and you begin to kind of develop a portfolio of skills and assets that I think will serve you well, whether you change jobs frequently or whether you are in a place and suddenly are given the pink slip.
And we'll get into some of those daily practices. But to back up what you just said about workers not feeling secure, you partnered with the research team at J. Walter Thompson, one of the largest ad agencies in the world, to get a sense of the shifting landscape. And you say that at the turn of the century, JWT started tracking the things that were making Americans anxious. And one of the findings consistently has been that about half of all Americans are feeling anxious about work.
Yeah, their job security, very much so. And in fact, I found a lot of that research when I was doing research about my book on emotion in the workplace, that, you know, anxiety about work just kept cropping up again and again. And so I wanted to sort of say, well, is there anything out there in the landscape that could actually make us feel less anxious about our working lives and put sort of power back into the employees' hands that was removed over the last couple of decades? And that's where I began to realize that it is one's appetite and kind of tolerance for risk that is a real differentiator in those who are more able to prosper in these very fluid working environment right now.
And the fluid working environment is more fluid than many of us realize. You talk about the average time people stay at a job.
Well, actually, the thing that staggered me, there was a very recent Pew data research that came out that says that even baby boomers are now on average in their jobs for only 5 years. You know, and if you look at the millennial cohort that's starting out, I think it's, you know, 1 year or 2 years. There's the expectation now, and it keeps changing and increasing every time I read a new piece of literature on the subject, that we might have 20 jobs in the course of our working lives, that you, by the time you're 38, I saw a recent study that said you might even have had those 20 jobs before you're even 38 years old. I mean, this is, we live in a time of just tremendous churn and upheaval in terms of the nature of work and the quality of work and the kinds of businesses that are being formed and or going out of business.
And it's not only the workers, it's also the people who own these companies, right?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that there's this expectation that, you know, you're only as good as your last success in any of these things. And I think companies are being challenged to look for ways to innovate as well. And I mean, one of the interesting things, I think, is that when companies devalue the role of their employees, they're being very short-sighted, I think, in their own interests, because they're thinking, well, I'm going to train all these young people and they're just going to be in their jobs for a year and that's a waste of my capital. But if you create an environment, my research found that the things that people value most in their workplace are being engaged in their work, feeling like they're learning and growing and being challenged, feeling valued and appreciated in their work. Those are the top things. They value that much more than they do flex time and any of the other things that you think might be out there. So if companies can kind of keep their employees feeling like they're learning and growing, then they can actually create this competitive advantage, I would argue, against anybody else, where they have people who are loyal and dedicated to seeing the success of the company.
You point out that even though 4 in 10 people don't think that they'll have the same job in a few years from now, they aren't doing anything about it.
No. I mean, I found the most sobering statistic for me was 50% of all Americans right now are thinking not only of changing their jobs, but of their careers. And those who are have no idea how to do it. And that, again, is what backs me into this sort of sense of creating a habit, a philosophy of experimentation, which is, you know, analogous in my mind with risk-taking.
This is Ann Kramer, and she's written this book called Risk Reward. It's about the need to take risks in our working lives to prosper in the 21st century. You spoke with a lot of people for this book in a lot of different careers about risk-taking. Who were some of the people you talked to?
Well, I talked to everybody from a range of, you know, everyday people. And then in the statistical research, I, in aggregate, talked to 3,000 Americans across the country in all kinds of professions. And then I wanted to sort of look at people who I thought might be more in the public eye in terms of successful risk-taking. So, you know, Jane Pauley, when she hosted her eponymous daytime talk show, spoke to me about what it meant for her to take that kind of a risk. Or Roseanne Cash, the musician, you know, is it different for people in the creative classes than it is for people in a business class? Sally Krawcheck, who's, you know, one of the Wall Street kind of goddesses. Tory Burch. I mean, I really wanted to kind of throw a wide net out there for people in a variety of fields. And, you know, some of them walk the talk, some of them learn from their mistakes, and all of them kind of possessed an internal kind of meter that allowed them to kind of have a North Star of self-awareness in some capacity about what was important to them to pursue.
Was there a particular story that stuck with you?
Well, I love the story of Brian Smith, who's a guy who lives in Brooklyn, New York, who had been an audiobook producer for Random House and then had gone out on his own and was a freelancer. And then when the revolution in e-book publishing happened and the upheaval that happened in that industry, he decided that what he really wanted to do was to make ice cream. But what he did is what I found was really fascinating, which is that he didn't just sort of do this overnight. He spent time, you know, creating ice creams in his kitchen with his family. And then he got a little cart and he went to Prospect Park in Brooklyn and he started selling his ice cream to people in the park. And he began to realize, well, I do like doing this. This is something I can envision doing long term. What are the economics of it? How can I kind of approach this? And he eventually built enough confidence for himself that he was able to lease a space in Brooklyn and opened a store. And what he did that was kind of transformative was he viewed the kind of art of making ice cream as this, as something similar to what he'd done in terms of producing audiobooks, which is the art of storytelling. And his kind of interestingly distinct competitive advantage in opening his shop was he made the making of the ice cream visible and transparent to the people standing and waiting in line. And so he was telling a story about what people were about to eat, and that became this kind of emotionally resonant thing for all the people, and it became this huge success, and he's opened up his second shop and, you know, is entertaining all sorts of other notions about how to expand and grow his business.
Well, and I guess we should point out, too, that he did the research. He didn't just jump from one thing blindly into making ice cream.
No, and I think that is a really key point, that, that really successful risk-taking requires what I call analysis. You know, you really look at, you know, are there gaps in the market? Is there something you can do? And then trial and error. And it's the trial and error piece that is the risk-taking piece. So, you know, he eventually, through his experimentation, backed into finding the ice cream flavors that were the most successful for him. You know, salted crack caramel is, I believe, his top seller. Mm. But then other kinds of, you know, stout-flavored beer ice creams and things that were right for the kind of Brooklyn audience. You know, trial and error and analysis. And you just keep iterating and reiterating and figuring out what works and experimenting.
This is Ann Kramer, and we're talking about her latest book called Risk Reward. It's about the shifting work landscape and what we need to do to prosper in the 21st century. We're going to take a quick break right here, and when we come back, we're going to get into the research about different personality types and how they correspond with our appetite for risk. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in today for Faith. We'll continue our conversation in 90 seconds. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack in for Faith, and we're talking with Ann Kramer about the changing landscape in our working lives. She knows a lot about this, has researched it, and writes regularly about today's work environment. Ann Kramer has written three books and currently blogs for Harvard Business Review and Next Avenue. Her latest book, which we're talking about today, is Risk Reward: Why Intelligent Leaps and Daring Choices Are the Best Career Moves You Can Make. So let's get into the research. You found that there are personality traits that correlate with an appetite for risk, and they've been narrowed down to four distinct clusters of people: pioneers, thinkers, defenders, and drifters. Do you want to say a little something about each of them?
Yeah. Pioneers were the smallest percentage of people that identified, about 10% of the population. Yet they made 17% more money than everybody else did. They are really the experimenters. That sense that sort of navigating your way through different opportunities, yielding more financial success, was verifiable in my research. But they did two other things that were really different from everybody else in the population. They answered the question that they used analysis to make their decision-making equally with the I trust my gut when making decisions. And I think this is something that as a culture we've sort of lost sight of, which is that intuition, that instinct, that gut feeling when things are right or not right, that became kind of devalued in both coming out of the Industrial Revolution, you know, where things were, you know, logical and streamlined and processed and had sort of mathematical underpinnings, and now in this world of sort of big data kind of driving everything. the pioneers understood that sometimes you have to have an instinct for when to take a risk, when to put your chip down, when to actually stop something if it's not yielding the right outcome. And no one else really did that. Everybody else relied very heavily on logic in terms of making their decisions. The other thing that the pioneers did, which I found really interesting, was they answered the question, sometimes I just do nothing at all, in the greatest percentage. And what that speaks to me is that they understood that you can't have output unless you actually have sort of nourishing and creative input, that you have to get off the treadmill sometimes to step back and have the perspective to see if there's an original idea in your mind, or you need to be having sort of interesting input from a variety of sources. And I mean, you know, everyone from Steve Jobs to Charles Dickens have followed this. You know, they walk, they get out, they're in unfamiliar neighborhoods, they have ideas coming to them from multiple vantage points. And that, I think, is a very important thing for those of us who are sort of stuck in our, you know, treadmill, to keep in mind that it's actually good for you to do different things that nourish yourself and give you new ideas. The thinkers, which is the largest percentage of the population, about 40% of the population, are people who believe that they have one really dominant thing that they're really good at. And that tends to kind of put people into the professional classes, you know, lawyers and doctors and bankers and people like that. And they develop expertise over time. But it's this group that actually suffers the most from burnout. They self-identify as being incredibly focused, incredibly reliable. They are the people you can turn to in a crunch and you know the work will get done. And as a result, I think they are often taken advantage of within traditional kind of corporate environments. You know, oh, there's Lori, I know she'll do that well. Let's just see. And so that person stays late, they burn out, and they lose their ability to even see if there's something exciting and interesting on the horizon line, or they aren't even aware of perhaps opportunities even happening in their own organization because they're so busy getting the job done. The third group I call the defenders, and they are also a significant portion of the population. And this is the kind of most risk-averse population in the country. This is a group who 100% said they hated surprises, 100% basically said they'd much rather have a secure $75,000-a-year job than ever risk the kind of potential upside of joining a startup or something. And I think this group is the most vulnerable to complacency. This group had the most group who thought that they would be in the same job 10 years from now. And I think that they're the ones also who have the greatest likelihood of being blindsided when, you know, if they were working at Countrywide or something, their company goes out of business. Mm. The last group is a group I call drifters, and that broke down into two cohorts. One was the group that I think is the most lost in our society right now. And I think as we enter the campaign season, it would behoove a lot of the politicians to kind of think about this group. And these are people who used to be in the manufacturing industry and who, as that's been sort of, you know, outsourced internationally, and as unions have kind of lost their, you know, saliency within manufacturing industry, these people have been downsized and fired out of jobs and are not really particularly clear about how they can revitalize their careers, what kind of new training they can even get. And then there's a group that I think is kind of a new group, which maybe almost harkens back to an era from the 60s, which I call the intentional drifters. Mm-hmm. And this is a group of people who tend to self-identify more with being craftspeople of some level. I think you can think of Etsy workers and, you know, people in that kind of industry being in the intentional drifting. And they are driven far more by personal growth and personal meaning and satisfaction than the other groups are. And so that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Right. And you go into much more detail and give examples. You also present a risk-reward matrix that anyone can use to identify their own innate risk threshold and identify constructive ways to implement risk.
Exactly. And people can go to my website if they want to take that. The purpose of that really is to help people understand you know, we're all multiple types, and we have primary and secondary characteristics, and we're different, you know, we're different at different stages of our life. You know, you might think that when you're a young person, you'd have a much greater appetite towards risk, but a lot of times young people can be afraid because they don't feel like they have the sort of skills to take, you know, daring leaps and jumps. And you might think that older people would be risk averse because of their responsibilities and different things. And different people are in different ways. So they're not, the groups are not meant to be sort of be-all and end-all. They're to give you insight into kind of your default orientation towards thinking about the new and novelty and change. And then hopefully to give you some strategies about what to do if you feel like you're thinking about change and you don't know how to sort of jumpstart that if you're any one of those groups.
This is Ann Kramer, and she's written this book called Risk Reward about the need to take risks in our working lives to prosper in the 21st century. Let's talk about some of those strategies. If you are, say, risk averse, can you give an example of how that might happen? Say you're one of these people who have been really busy with just raising a family, trying to pay the bills, and you haven't been thinking about this stuff. Where do you start?
Yeah, it's challenging. We're all like, well, I don't even have time to think about any of this stuff. I can barely, you know, get my head out of bed in the morning. I'm so exhausted. I think it is taking one of the chapters from the Pioneers, which is try to figure out what you find personally and emotionally or, you know, sort of spiritually nourishing, and do invest in that if you can. So that can be something that you are volunteering within your church group, for instance. Well, you might find out that they need somebody to organize their books in some area, and you're a bookkeeper. So you can begin to do that, and you can develop a different kind of network with people of opportunity. And somebody that you are working with in that committee, for instance, could then say to you, oh, I heard about this opportunity at X company down the block. They're looking for somebody who has skills very similar to you. Are you interested in that? Because one of the interesting findings that sociologists from Stanford has found is that people don't really get their next jobs through the people that they work with. They get them through a loose association of people that you see on a relatively regular basis. But it's not your best friend, and it's not your colleagues at work. It might be the people that you know, or in a knitting group with. It might be the people you end up playing golf with. I do think there's a reason why historically a lot of deals, you know, in the old kind of cliche of bankers doing deals on the golf course, well, I think it worked because you're in this kind of social environment. You're not necessarily feeling in the office, but you can have conversations about work and about opportunity that are different. So I would suggest for that mom, if there's maybe there's a play group that you go to with your kid if you can't figure out a way to sort of carve out time. I also think you can jumpstart by sort of exploring and thinking critically about, are my skills really up to date? Let's say you're interested in trying to, you know, be involved more in the social media aspect of your company. Well, if you don't know anything about it, the simplest thing you can do is start your own Twitter account, you know, set up your own website, use WordPress to do something. You know, Lynda.com, which was just bought by LinkedIn, has a whole series of online courses that you can take that can help you sort of get more abreast of technology-based industries or design industries or things that you might not necessarily have fluency in. You can find these things online and get training. But the best way is just to experiment and do it yourself.
We've been talking about risks and, you know, changing jobs. You're not suggesting that we shouldn't have goals. In fact, you pretty much make the case that keeping your goals at the top of the list helps you take the risks that often lead to those very same goals.
Well, I think having goals is helpful. What I don't necessarily advocate is that you need to quit your day job before you begin to experiment in other areas, which is why I was sort of suggesting for the person who, you know, you have your mortgage to pay, you have your, you know, student loans to pay off. You can't just overnight stop doing what you're doing. But there are ways that you can sort of define your time in your workspace so that you can create other time outside of your office and do volunteers or extra course study and begin to figure out ways that you can leverage yourself into your next job. I mean, I think one of my kind of mantras is, make the job you want rather than quit the job you hate, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So it's like start playing around the edges of an opportunity. I mean, a young woman who I've written about for Harvard Business Review but I haven't written this particular story about her. She's a young student who just graduated from Portland State in Oregon. And she'd been interning at Adidas and was interested in trying to figure out a way that she could have a full-time position there. And she decided she wanted to create a women's empowerment kind of initiative for the organization. So she went and she shot videos of her own friends and kind of created a curriculum and came up with the whole Facebook strategy and then went to the woman that she'd been working for saying, I would love to do this for you. Well, all of us can kind of do things like that within whatever company we're working in. If we see, you know, something that we think that we'd be better served at doing, or we see something that's not really happening, you sort of think, you know, you tease around the edges of that and come up with a program and approach your boss. And 99 times out of 100, I think, most people want people to come to them with good, innovative ideas that they want to kind of champion.
So this story you were just talking about with the student leads into this next question. Do you think we should be changing the way that we're educating our children?
Well, I think there's a couple of layers of this. I do think that education has probably moved into this, you know, overprescribed SAT-driven kind of approach, and that's the only way you can kind of get into the college of your dreams. And I think experience should be far more valuable in that regard, in terms of just accruing a different kinds of skill sets as you're a young person and in college, working in a variety of different arenas, whether it's, you know, volunteering in a hospital, working in a shelter, doing all sorts of things. You learn a tremendous amount about yourself doing a variety of different things.
Makes you an interesting person.
Yes, and I think, you know, lateral is the new vertical, I think, in terms of our professional lives. I don't think we should particularly be thinking about moving, you know, sort of up a chain of command so much as working, you know, other people have said this other than I, but like, you know, life now is much more, working life is much more about rock climbing. You know, you're kind of constantly looking for the grip back and forth and sideways, always kind of moving forward or upward in some direction, but it's not this sort of straight path anymore. It's a zigzaggy kind of make it up as you go along kind of course. And I think young people need to figure out sort of creative problem-solving skills and resiliency skills and what to do when it doesn't work out when you're going in that one path. How do you sort of course correct without feeling that you're a failure? How do you kind of learn to keep your energy levels up and going? You know, there's a lot that can be done, but I don't think we're teaching people how to work in this new world of uncertainty at all.
Is there a dark side to risk?
Yes, there is. I mean, you know, the pioneers do tend to be more a bit of the people who, you know, drive too fast and probably drink and take drugs and sort of experiment in those ways. And I think that that can sometimes lead to incautious, you know, I'm out of here, I'm going to go start this tomorrow, without doing your homework, without really doing the due diligence of, you know, situational analysis and competitive analysis and kind of the kinds of things I was talking about the ice cream maker doing in terms of perfecting his formula, finding out it was a good emotional fit for him, those kinds of things. And I think it can also lead to a bit of, you know, hubris on some level of just, you know, I'm better, you know, I'm good at this. There is data out there, Daniel Kahneman, who wrote the wonderful book Thinking Fast and Slow, you know, there's a danger within corporations to think that one risk will pay off the second time. The data doesn't necessarily prove that that's true. Just because you started one company successfully doesn't mean the next one you do will be successful. So we're always kind of having to tack and turn with the kind of courses in the river that we're operating in to kind of figure out what will work.
This is Ann Kramer, and she's written this book called Risk Reward. It's about the need to take risks in our working lives to prosper in the 21st century. And to go back to risk profiles for a second, when you were conducting research, did you notice a pattern in the natural risk takers versus the people who were maybe a little uncomfortable with risk? For example, you know, did the people who are comfortable with taking risks come from larger families, two-parent homes, anything
that
sticks out?
That's a great question, Lori. And the fact of the matter is, no. There was a very tiny skew of this group towards male, but not really. Everybody was pretty much evenly divided gender and very much evenly divided across, you know, all kind of demographic sort of components. there were people who would say, you know, I come from an immigrant family, and so I was taught to, you know, work incredibly hard and never take any risks, and then who rebel against that. Or there's another group of people who came from parents who just, you know, swung from the fences, and it's like you'd think that might encourage them to be in a similar vein. And like, you know, Alex Keaton in that Trading Spaces television sitcom from years ago, they become extremely cautious and conservative because they felt like the behavior they observed was reckless. So there's no rule of thumb or benchmark or anything, and I really do believe that all of us can develop our muscles for venturing out of our comfort zones very successfully. You know, simply ask somebody at your workplace to have coffee with you one day that you might not ordinarily do. That builds confidence. All these little steps create a kind of sense of confidence and a sense of sort of personal agency in the direction that our lives are taking, and that serves you well during uncertain times.
It seems like there's a lot of soul searching that needs to be done. In other words, if you've been going along, just like I had mentioned before, paying the bills, raising the family, and weren't thinking much about your passions in life, is that the first logical step?
I think that's one of the logical steps. I think we all do actually know our guts pretty well. A woman whose story didn't make it into the book, but is an editor who I spent time with, who'd had a great job and kind of knew the writing was on the wall for her in her experience, but just didn't want to confront her boss because she was afraid of getting the bad news. Mm. If you have that feeling, then there's no question the bad news is actually probably coming. And that the best thing you could probably do is go to your boss and say, look, I've got, you know, I'm feeling pretty anxious about this. Can we talk about this? And then the boss can either say, well, you're right, we're thinking of eliminating this division, which is what happened to the woman I'm talking about. Or they can say, yeah, we're really worried, and we think that we need to be retooling ourselves to do this, and we're just not sure you've got the skills, in which case you can take a course preemptively and get the skills. So rather than being fired without ever having had the conversation, you can at least have teed up something to have knowledge. Or if the boss says, you know, we're selling the whole company to something and we're all going to be losing our jobs, but, you know, at least you have 2 months' notice, perhaps.
So it's being proactive.
You're just being proactive. We all do know when either we think our performance is not meeting up to par, or when we think that we're being overlooked for promotion, or when people are gossiping in the, you know, corridors about things. Pretending it doesn't exist is truly the riskiest thing you can do in this working environment, because you're going to be caught short and you're going to be surprised.
Well, and on the opposite end of that, you also talk about going out on top.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we should all be so lucky.
That's right. We should all be so lucky
in those positions. But I do talk about a few people who, the kind of amateur spirit, that kind of sense of personal reinvention, the kind of, you know, Benjamin Franklin, I'm going to be a statesman and a eyeglass maker and an inventor and all those things. There are people who feel that need to kind of, once they've done something for some period of time, they get bored and they need to continue to challenge themselves. And Mihaly Csizmielski, the flow psychologist, says that we are at our kind of happiest and most productive in our working lives when we are being challenged just enough, not over-challenged, because if you're over-challenged, you kind of shut down, but not bored. It's like when you're bored, you really shut down. Mm. And that's, again, what my research said. Employees are at their happiest when they feel like they're learning and they're growing and they're continuing to kind of expand their repertoire of the things that they can do and that they'll become good at. And so the people, some of the people who kind of leave at the top of their game have an inner sense of when that moment is where they're at that kind of peak place and they're about to go down the other side of the hill into boredom, and they act. You know, and change leads to insight almost always. You know, Milton Erickson said this, more than insight leads to change. We can all think and think and think and think and think, but until you begin to take action, you can't begin to put the edges around a new idea you might have for a business, or a new opportunity you think might be good for your company, or even the awareness that you know, what you've been doing is stale and you really need to kind of rev up your game a little bit.
What would you like people to take away from this book?
That we're all in the same boat And I think that that is actually an encouraging thing, that none of us really have a roadmap for what this, you know, self-employed 21st century, no pensioned world feels like, that we can turn to each other for help, that when we are all changing jobs as frequently as we are, the good news is that nothing is forever. So if you start down a path and it doesn't turn out to be what you thought it was going to be, it's not the end of the world to change. You know, you're not stuck in it for the next 35 years of your life. You can actually think of alternatives, and because there is such fluidity and there is such movement and kind of innovation going on, you might find something else that's even better. The National Bureau of Economic Research just came out with a study in 2014 that found that, you know, young workers who sample more occupations, you know, those who view each job hop as a chance to discover work that's meaningful to them, made significantly more money in their 30s and their 40s. So there's correlation between navigating, you know, risking your way in different jobs to your true calling and actually a higher income.
You quote a lot of people throughout this book, and toward the end you have a quote by the poet Mary Oliver. She says, "Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" Maybe yeah. That's a good place to start.
I think so. I really do think so. And, you know, all of us can tap around the edges of that, you know, no matter what kind of a job we're in. You know, I mean, you can decide, I am going to do this job because it's the tool that will enable me to spend my nights and my weekends writing poetry. That's a perfectly acceptable place to be in your life. You just have to define it and say, that's what I'm comfortable doing.
It's an eye-opening book and also very hopeful. Thank you for writing it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Ann Kramer, her latest book is Risk Reward: Why Intelligent Leaps and Daring Choices Are the Best Career Moves You Can Make. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith. Next, Faith talks with author Pamela Katz about her book, The Partnership. Thanks for listening.
I'm Faith Middleton. Join the conversation with us on Twitter at FaithWNPR. Now we have for our author interview in this segment of the show, Pamela Katz, whose new book is called The Partnership, and it's about Kurt Vile, Bertolt Brecht, and the making of the Three Penny Opera in the late 1920s, and also about the women who were their lovers and possibly did significant writing without credit. Pam Katz, our guest, is a screenwriter, quite a good one, and also did the film Hannah Arendt that was selected by the New York Times as one of the top 10 films of the year in 2013. A terrific film. I'm going to do something I rarely do, which is to read some of the jacket copy, because I was going to rewrite this, and I thought, you know, this is better than I probably can do, and it catches us all up. If you have heard of Three Penny Opera and Kurt Vile and Bertolt Brecht, you know, from American theater, but you still might be saying to yourself, as I did, because this was a new story to me, I thought, you know, I don't know much about La Dalena. Who really was that? And what was going on in that time? Listen to this. Among the most creative and outsized personalities of the Weimar Republic, that sizzling yet decadent epoch between the Great War and the Nazis' rise to power, were the renegade poet and dramatist Bertolt Brecht and the reserved yet rebellious avant-garde composer Kurt Vile. These two young geniuses and the three women vital to their work, actresses La Dalena, Helene Weigel, and writer Elisabeth Hauptmann, joined talents to create the theatrical and musical masterworks, the Three Penny Opera, the Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, only to split and rancor as their culture cracked open and their aesthetic and temperamental differences became irreconcilable. You know, we have these great works in our history and we think, how did that come to be? We think to ourselves, you know, why didn't they stay together? What went on? And here is an example of this. Our author is somebody who's gone into this story. So The Partnership is the first book to tell the full story of the compelling psychological drama of Brecht and Vile's impulsive, combustible partnership. This is one of the most important creative collaborations of the past century. Very unlikely partners these two were. One of them charismatic, unkempt, Marxist, intellectual, high artistic and social moral ideas and a questionable personal morals. And then we have Weil, who was this a polite, cultured Jew, dignified demeanor, but a musical rebel. And they get brought together because they're in this kind of outside the box time between the war and the Nazis. So Pam Katz, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What a fascinating story. Can I ask you, you know, here you are a screenwriter. You started out in film long ago. What in the world made you turn to this?
Well, it was kind of a long time coming. It's partly my own personal story. My father's a German Jewish emigre who came to this country in 1940.
And you married a German?
I married a German who, and I lived in Berlin for many years and worked on a variety of German projects and stories. But I wanted to say, once you dip your toe into the Weimar Republic, you are so fascinated that you can't get out as a writer until you find what you think might be the perfect way to tell the story of this incredible time.
Now, what is it about this time? Because this is the end of one war, and now the Nazis are just coming in, and you have us in Berlin, you have us in Germany, and I'm thinking to myself, eventually you have us in America in the theater world, but I'm thinking to myself, I had no idea. I know things about the war. I had no idea about this period and how this kind of flourishing, how radio was seen as this populist device that could spread culture to people. I mean, what an amazing time.
It was an amazing time. There were 2 million radios in Germany in 1927 alone. And that in and of itself transformed the way in which theater and music was transmitted to the public.
So we know, just as we know some of these classic names from the past, Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht, we know a little something about them, Lotte Lenya. How important were the things that they did?
Well, extremely important, and in two ways. If you're talking about the time itself, it's a time when the very definition of art and culture was being completely reinvented.
In what way?
In the sense that prior to, say, the abdication of the Kaiser in the wake of the disastrous defeat of World War I, culture, high culture, was something that was by and about and for the lords and ladies. It was for people of the elite class. In the wake of the abdication and the political and social transformation, the idea of what art should be was changed completely. And Brecht is actually famously quoted, and also in my book, is saying, if the times no longer fit into the drama, then the drama no longer works for the times. And Weill said the same thing about music. He said, if opera can't cross the bounds of what they called Zeittheater, which was theater of the times, then the bounds must be broken. So they came together, and they decided that they were going to create a musical theater, and they were going to create music and theater separately for the people. A very complex notion, but that's something everybody was doing during the Weimar Republic. The Royal Theater, the Royal Opera was overnight the state theater, the state opera. It was no longer funded by royalty, it was funded by the government, and therefore it had an obligation to serve the people. And people talk about the Threepenny Opera as the first opera for the people that the people actually liked. And that was really their first accomplishment, was to make something that was entertaining, accessible, and available, but still intelligent.
Why did the Threepenny Opera become so famous?
Everybody has a different opinion on that. Interestingly, some people will tell you, well, it's the music. It was the brilliance of the music. That's true insofar as it's the brilliance of the songs. We must remember that this is the musical that had Mack the Knife, a song that has been recorded by everybody in the world 1,000 times. So that song lives in the popular imagination all over the world. So I think it was the song style that they created, where you had these very ironic and satirical lyrics combined with this beautiful music. And you could hum about the most awful things. But what I think the real longevity of the Threepenny Opera is that it is the anti-authority. It is the play that makes fun of the monarchy, of the bourgeoisie. Brecht has a famous essay, is the bandit a bourgeois or all the bourgeois bandits? So it works in any time as the counterculture, the counter-authority piece. And that's why it's continually performed and meaningful no matter where you are or when you are.
And so relevant to what happened with Hitler coming in, appealing to the working class and saying, you know, you real Germans have been suffering too long, and we're going to change things and make things better for you. The link between those two things, I mean, certainly I'm not saying that working class art leads to people like Hitler all the time, but it's really a fascinating connection.
Yeah, I mean, there was competition for the working class in that time in Germany. You know, the communists and the National Socialists were fighting for their attention because each knew that was the key to their triumph.
So the women in the lives of Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill figure prominently in your story in a way that they haven't in other books. And let's talk about that.
There's been actually has been much written about the scandalous Brecht who seduced all these women and mm-hmm. stole their work. And there are pieces of the truth in that. But the answer to that in Germany by the feminists has been, how dare you demean the women like that? They were Marxist heroines and they believed in what they were doing. Elisabeth Hauptmann, who I talk a lot about in the book, who is the woman who found the play upon which the Threepenny Opera was based, translated it and gave it to Brecht, has the credit as translator. She was a Marxist, did believe in collective work. She also gave Brecht and Weill a lot of the works that they then adapted later. But she's been co-opted. She's either a Marxist heroine on the one side or a lovesick victim on the other. And I tried very hard to examine her mm-hmm. in more detail and with more nuance, which she so richly deserves. So I neither hold to the idea that Brecht was a monstrous exploiter, about which many books have been written, nor do I think the deal was always equal. But one thing you can say, Elisabeth Hauptmann, Helena Weigel, who became his wife, who was a brilliant actress, we know her from Mother Courage. She ran mm-hmm. the Berliner Ensemble for decades. They were brilliant women. And the other women who I don't focus on as much, there were many more, they were always brilliant. And for him, that work connection was erotic. Did it have exploitative elements? Yes. But was it only that? No. Because these women were too smart to mm-hmm. be simply
yeah.
exploited.
They sure had to, were.
Yeah.
When you're done with this story, and I can see that this has taken years, and you send this off to the world, what do you want to have happen? What do you want to make people understand in the end?
I wrote this book for you, in fact, for people like you who, as you say, you're very well read, incredibly intelligent, but didn't know much about this time. So I wrote the book for people who would be learning about these people for the first time. That said, I did do a tremendous amount of research. So one is simultaneously writing a book that you hope will earn the respect of all the experts you interviewed, all the archivists that helped you find lost letters and who helped you work your way through the material. That's what I was hoping for, was to feel that I'd gotten my facts straight for the experts,
yeah.
but far more important, that I was able to bring this time alive for a public that hadn't known about them before.
Also, there's something in here for me about collaboration. We all think that you have to get along to do these works of genius, and it turns out you don't. That's what you made me understand. I thought, wow, they can still respect each other and truly dislike each other and keep going.
They
break up in the end, but still.
Yes, they managed to work together even when they weren't getting along. The last work they did together, The Seven Deadly Sins, they did in 1933. They were both in exile in Paris. They didn't want to work together. Weill had been given the commission. He asked Jean Cocteau. He said no. And then the producer who was giving him the commission said, what about Brecht? You two are so famous in Paris for the Threepenny Opera. And I think out of sympathy for a fellow exile, and kind of begrudgingly, Weill said, okay, come on in. But even at the worst point in their lives, Weill said that Brecht was one of the most repulsive people running around on this earth.
Yeah, so, you know, in the beginning, they pretty quickly, to me anyway, maybe not in the arc of all the research you've done, but pretty quickly to me, I thought, well, they don't really like each other. And yet they're doing these incredible things. Each saw in the other a chance to do something that had never been done before. You taught me a lot with this story. Really, thank you so much for that. Pam Katz, The Partnership is the first book to tell the full story of the compelling psychological drama of Brecht and Weill's impulsive combustible partnership. The Faith Middleton Show airs at 3 and 9 p.m. on WNPR. Check out our guest lineup and join the conversation with us and other listeners on Facebook. Just search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to our talented team, producer Jonathan McNichol and senior producer Lori Mack. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.